Good evening, and welcome. My name is Meghnad Desai. We are going to have this very interesting and engaging discussion about accountability and how the civil society makes a difference. I'm going to be chairing. I'm not going to be a speaker, which is, I think, the finance really shut me up. But I will no doubt say something provocative later on. I think I should say that we're trying to generate a debate here as far as possible. I myself don't actually believe in corporate accountability at all, except in the sense of good, honest accounting. But that's another. I think the corporations ought to make profit and then shut up. But that's my own view. We have three speakers. We have Adele Simmons, who is was MacArthur Foundation, but is a free soul, free and critical soul, spanning many continents. We've just been talking about how she was in Africa, and she's obviously an American and has been here very long and very often. We have Noreena Hertz, who is from as far away as Cambridge, which is a foreign country, as Viva can tell you, and she runs a center there at the Judge Institute. And then we have a real live businessman, and that's Paul Everard, who was a real live businessman. Well, he's a capitalist, and like all good capitalists, he's immensely rich, I think. I don't know.
It's all under the mattress,
mate. Okay, I think what we're going to do, we're going to start with Adele, and then Paul, and then Noreena. And then I will also do a little bit more introduction at that stage.
Okay.
Oh, incidentally, there are cameras around, so all of you are supposed to smile throughout this seminar, or there will be questions asked.
I want to thank Meghnad and Mary Calder and all of you for inviting me here, and also for the opportunity to participate in the writing of a chapter for this famous Global Civil Society Yearbook, which I understand would be a bestseller in the United States if the Oxford University Press could figure out how to distribute it there. But it is an enormously useful and important collection of essays. And I was asked to write for that on a topic that I'd been working on while I was at the MacArthur Foundation, which is really the relationship between civil society organizations and corporations, and how this relationship in its many forms would actually promote the public interest and make the world a better place for our environment, for workers, and for corporations. And what's interesting is we all sort of think of our own moment as being new and the time when something was discovered. But in fact, civil society has held multinational corporations responsible for their actions for a very long time. What I'm going to do today, after a couple historical references, is kind of talk about the ways in which civil society organizes itself to foster corporate responsibility and consider some of its accomplishments and some of the limits. I'm sort of providing the roadmap so that then Paul and Noreena can argue about whether it works and what works and why. But just let's go back, because it all kind of began in London in about 1787 when Thomas Clarkson and a dozen other people met in a Quaker bookshop here and decided they thought the slave trade was a bad thing and that maybe a little pressure should be put on the shipping industry that was carrying goods back and forth from the West Indies. And 5 years later, remarkably without the help of the internet, about 400,000 people in England were boycotting sugar and other products that were produced by slave labor. The momentum was building, and the Napoleonic Wars intervened, so the slave trade wasn't abolished for quite a while later. Skipping ahead, most of you know the story of E.D. Morrell, who exposed the horrific labor conditions in King Leopold's Congo. Workers were extracting labor there under terrible, terrible conditions. And the movement protesting against these practices spread to the United States, Australia. It was really global. And it led to the transfer of the Congo from the king to the government of Belgium. But the follow-up was cut short. once again by a war, World War I. As Belgium became a victim, it was no longer possible for civil society to treat Belgium as a victim on our side. Most recently, civil society groups argued that multinationals, simply by operating in South Africa, were supporting the policies of apartheid. And the result is that many businesses withdrew. The current burst of civil society activity is really a response to and a part of the globalization efforts, all of which you know about. As the multinationals became global, so did civil society shortly afterwards. What I want to do is talk about these organizations, how they work, and what leads to their successes and their limits. Civil society organizations dealing with corporate responsibility vary enormously. They use a wide variety of tools, and it's the combination of these different types of organizations using these very different tools that leads to their success. Civil society groups, such as interfaith groups, tend to be very international and cover a wide range of issues. There are some civil society groups that are a single issue, environment, children. They may be organized by industry, the apparel industry, or by company, such as Nike Watch. Some are identified by tactics, boycotts, legal actions, partnerships, or multi-stakeholder strategies. Some are very local, familiar with the local conditions, but don't have a lot of capacity to galvanize an international movement. And some, as I mentioned, using the interfaith groups as an example, are very international in their reach. Most civil society groups have either outsider tactics or insider tactics. Let me tell you about that. The outsiders take direct action. Boycotts, in the case of the tuna boycott, they may occupy something. Julia Butterfly Hill became very famous in the United States when she climbed a tree thinking she'd be there for about a week to make a point that it shouldn't be cut down. It was one of these old, beautiful sequoias. Well, she was there for 2 years. She was helped by an enormously inept corporation, Pacific Lumber, who, in spite of the movie stars and rock stars that would kind of go to Julia's tree, they would send in helicopters to buzz her and continue to threaten to cut the tree down. Most of us think some kind of an agreement could have been reached to get Julia down that from that tree in less than 2 years, but we're still talking about her because she was there for 2 years. Some outsider groups take legal action, and it's interesting that in the UK and in the US, when a plaintiff cannot bring a human rights case in the country where the human rights problem is, if that corporation has its headquarters in either the UK or the US, the case can be brought in the UK or US courts. So there are a series of cases now, and the most recent one we'll expect to result from soon is one on Unocal, working their way through courts both in your country and in mine. The boycotts, the site occupations, sometimes boarding ships as the tuna people did, Greenpeace you know about, and lawsuits all attract attention to the company. And they raise for the company the question of reputational risk. What happens to a company if it does something that is seen by the consumers as generally anti-labor or anti the environment? So now you don't always have to boycott or occupy a site. You can threaten, as happened when Mitsubishi wanted to take 64,000 acres of a World Heritage site in Mexico and use it for a salt plant. It was stopped simply because of the threat of a boycott. But without this direct action, I'll give you a good example, it's very difficult for people who want to make things different really do it. A bunch of kids in the United States sent in their styrofoam packaging that their McDonald's hamburgers came in, and suddenly the McDonald's Corporation was getting flooded by all these styrofoam clamshells. And McDonald's was saying, what do I do? Well, they weren't going to call the kids to say to help us, but they found a civil society group that had environmental interests, that had on its board corporate CEOs, people who understood their corporate problems, and said, help us. And the result was a complete redesign of all the packaging of McDonald's. Now, these outside groups were sitting there watching this process with great skepticism. And in fact, that process meant that they were holding accountable both McDonald's and the inside environmental group. And it is that interrelationship between the two that makes it work. There's another group of civil society people who are really set up and designed by business leadership. The World Business Council for Sustainable Development, the Prince of Wales Trust, there are a slew of them. And they are out there trying also to advise corporations about how you can do things better. Some just because they want to and they believe in it, and some because they're trying to protect their reputations. Governments have been involved. Tony Blair helped to set up the Ethical Trading Initiative. Clinton set up a, I think inspired by Blair, set up something called the Apparel Industry Partnership, which began as a disaster, but has now morphed into something called the Fair Labor Association that actually has some impact. But once everybody agrees to do things differently, how do you know what's going to happen? The next layer of civil society groups are involved in monitoring, setting standards, and figuring out how you hold these corporations accountable. How do you certify these products? Who does the auditing? How are you sure that when Nike says actually the shoe is being made with glue that isn't toxic, that happens? I'm not going to go into that process itself. It's long and complicated, but this is the area where civil society has made a huge amount of progress. There's also a long way to go. Local groups have to be involved so that in an employment situation, there are off-site interviews, people are involved. There's a lot of questions about transparency and enormous issues that the unions raise about freedom of association. Is all of this voluntary stuff designed simply to keep workers from organizing? Or can you have these voluntary systems with corporations involved that also ensure freedom of association? Well, that raises the question of, so why are governments doing all this? In an ideal world, you'd have governments with great laws enforcing these great laws. But it's not so simple. Most of the governments where countries where many of these sweatshop groups are don't have the capacity to monitor them. And most of them want to attract foreign direct investment. So they're under enormous pressure from the companies saying, if you want to locate here, we need minimum standards. So you really can't count a lot on governments to come through. In some cases they do, but it's not consistent. And also, you don't then have uniform standards, although the ILO is working in that area. Well, where are we now? I think first we should celebrate the fact that civil society groups have gotten companies to take responsibility for the conditions under which their products are made, even if they don't own the plant. In other words, it used to be the front line of defense was, well, we don't own that plant, it's a bunch of Taiwanese who own it. Well, I'm sorry, you're now responsible as the large multinational for the working conditions in those plants. And that has been an enormous success. Many corporations have improved their practices. The unions are far less opposed now to these voluntary restraints, voluntary actions than they used to be. But there are certain problems with this reality too. First of all, if you take a country like Vietnam, it's only the multinationals that are trying to improve their conduct. There are a zillion other small companies owned inside the country or that are under the big radar screen that nobody is paying attention to. And no company is perfect. BP, which is one of the poster children for responsible activity, particularly around global warming, acquired Amoco, which thinks drilling in the Arctic refuge is just fabulous. And some of the CSOs are part of the problem, the civil society groups, because they tend to be very arbitrary. In fact, Nike, who you've heard a lot about, has made an enormous, come a long way. It's made a lot of progress. It's still hounded by civil society. And one of them, someone who works for one of these companies, said, but what about Walmart? And what about ExxonMobil? If you say ExxonMobil to one of the oil companies like BP, their executives just roll their eyes. How come they get away with being one of the worst environmental companies around? So the civil society groups only take on certain targets, and they miss some pretty big fish. They also look around this room and think about all the things that have been made somewhere. You don't know where, you don't know how, you don't know under what conditions, because they're not brand names. They're not Nike shoes up on that screen. So nobody is monitoring a whole bunch of products that are made that don't attract consumers. The other final thing is that the civil society groups that are based in the North tend to focus on the issues that you and I think are important, that may not be the important issues to the workers on site. And we're getting a lot of social science research now from worker interviews, whatever, that are identifying the priorities of these workers. And we now need to be sure that we focus on what's important to the people working in these plants. I'm sorry, I'm talking more about work than worker conditions in the environment. Then we need to decide what we would like. Research is showing, for example, that in Bangladesh, what women want most of all is access to bank accounts. They get paid. They go home to their village with their money. Their father or their uncle or their brother takes the money. It's the last they see of it. Please help them open a bank account. This is not a big deal for a corporation, but it's a huge deal for these women. So let's try as civil society groups to focus more and more on what's important. What are the big challenges? Well, when I mentioned the first two historical stories, you will note that they both movements ended because of a war. And the question is whether we're going to be facing the same thing now. It's absolutely clear that campus interest in the United States is no longer as intensively focused on these issues because people are spending their time organizing about the war. I've not talked about the social responsible investing movement, which is a whole other piece where there are huge opportunities for impact. I see this as a big challenge, a big opportunity, and a place where a lot of difference is being made. Finally, I see the Olympics in China as an enormous opportunity. People will be looking very carefully at human rights issues in China coming up before 2008. And I think this is an opportunity for civil society to work with corporations. Some enormous progress has been made, and we could take advantage of this window to make a huge difference in China. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Amanda.
Well, as Magnus has said, I'm the practitioner. Perhaps I'm this sort of evening's anticlimax as well. Just a little bit of, I'm here on a personal basis, although I do work for a company, a mining company called BHP Billiton. My background is almost 30 years in Shell, 10 years in East Africa, starting off as a kerosene salesman, and then moving into a company called Billiton, which was bought by Shell in the early 70s. That's a mining company. And I basically sort of stayed in that area ever since. But we were sold off to a South African company in the mid-90s called Gencor. And then we merged with an Australian company 2 years ago called BHP. So we're now BHP Billiton. So that's my background. I'm essentially going to focus on corporate social responsibility. Businesses give a lot of attention to that area, and that's the phrase which characterizes it. And the context within which I'd like to look at it is, first of all, primarily market economies. I think it was Hayek who said that the biggest single change from sort of arbitrary power to choices exercised by individuals was created by the introduction or the movement towards a market economy in the 17th, 18th centuries. And when you were moving from companies in places like Holland and England, where you had to have a royal charter, so in the East India Company, the Dutch East Indian Company, which were monopolies, to joint stock companies where you had competition and freedom of choice. Also, preferably, very strong preference within the framework of a plural political society, i.e. where people freely choose the people who act on their behalf and govern. Now, within that context, I think business has a single focus, and that is economic. And the yardstick against which you measure the success of that business is profit and profitability. Now, that profit arises because the business produces goods or services which customers want. And only if customers want and purchase that in competition with other businesses will it thrive. And the profitability, sort of on a minimum basis, needs certainly to be sufficient to cover the risks of whatever that business is doing. And if it wishes to grow, then it has to generate surpluses which will enable it to grow. Whether you look at it legally or whether you look at it from the point of view of an economist, they both, binocular vision, focus on the shareholder of those businesses, and the ultimate purpose of that business is to reward that shareholder, otherwise he will take his money elsewhere and invest it elsewhere. If you look at modern businesses, I mean, Shell, since I left it, has undergone sort of huge change and is addressing the question of sort of triple line accounting, sort of not only economic but social and environmental. And other companies are doing things similar. Most international companies have charters and statements of business principles. And other than the shareholder, who is often just one stakeholder amongst others in these documents, you have employees, you have customers, you have suppliers. And also, issues feature very significantly in those statements, particularly related to the environment and the question of sustainability, and issues of contribution to the community. Now, I would argue that those are all legitimate factors which a business needs to take account of, but it takes account of it in the context of its overall primary economic objective. In other words, it acts with regards to those stakeholders in such a way as to be good for the business itself. If you move away from that, and if you say that the business is going to have separate objectives with regard to, for example, environmental sustainability, and separate objectives with regard to community actions, then I think you create a conflict and you create confusion, because the people running that business are really driven to make subjective decisions as to which is prime in any particular situation. And I think it was Friedman who said that self-selected, non-elected individuals, limited number of individuals, really have no role in arbitrarily deciding themselves what is the social good. We elect governments to pursue the public good, and it is governments via legislation, via the executive, which should decide how businesses in a contextual situation should most effectively pursue that public good. And broadly, I think that works. I think I always think the cup is half full, and I therefore think that the world is actually getting sort of better generally rather than worse. And I can take some sort of historical examples which I think support the economic primacy. I'd like to take General Motors. General Motors, there was a phrase over 50 years ago about General Motors when it was the dominant company in the US economy, made a tremendous contribution to the war effort in the Second World War, etc. And there was a phrase which said, you know, what's good for General Motors is good for America. And this implicitly does actually suggest that they sort of, you know, were taking a position on making a social judgment of what was in the public good. Now, at the time that that phrase was current, Galbraith, the economist at Harvard, was writing a book called The New Industrial State, which was actually severely critical of producers in society and suggesting that they were going to sort of dominate and dictate to consumers, you know, what they could buy and what they couldn't buy. And General Motors could be taken as a sort of example of, you know, what's good for us is good for you, mate. If we, as Galbraith was writing and as GM were acting, the Japanese were entering the sort of automobile market in the States. Everyone laughed about them in the 50s, they stopped laughing in the 60s, and GM, 10 years later in the 70s, on the back of the OPEC crisis, was really trumped. I think the most admired automobile company in the world now, I think, is Toyota. And GM have never really recovered, I don't think, from the reverses they suffered sort of through the late 60s, the 70s, and the 80s. And that's a good example of the sort of primacy of the consumer and of what happens to companies when they cease to pay attention to the consumer and providing goods in the most efficient and economic way to them. Now, that's an interesting anecdote for two other reasons. The first is that in the 40s, there was a management commentator who'd just emigrated to the States. He was a Jewish refugee from Austria, called Peter Drucker. And he was asked by Alfred Sloan, who was the CEO and I suppose chairman of General Motors, to do a review, independent review of the way the company was working, etc., which he did. And Sloan so disliked that review, which was subsequently published as a book called The Concept of the Corporation, that it is said that his own book, which he wrote on retirement in the mid-50s, called My Years with General Motors, was written as a direct rebuttal of the Drucker book. Now, they're both actually wonderful books if you're interested in microeconomics, and they're both, I don't know, are they still read? Are they still used at business schools? Anyway, the key point that Drucker identified was that General Motors' weaknesses was it was introspective, concerned with itself, not sensitive to what was happening in the environment, in society, around it. And if General Motors didn't manage that situation, they would suffer reverses. And they ignored that advice, and they did suffer reverses. You could quote examples of situations where you could say that other companies today in the world, you could ask whether they're paying sufficient attention to the environment and to their customers, you know, vis-a-vis their actions by you know, analogy with the General Motors story. Now, the legislative framework and the guidelines in society, I mean, aren't perfect. And I think one of the issues, which hopefully is beginning to get sort of, you know, better rather than worse now, is the distinction between public and private costs. I mean, when we in a business look at an investment proposal, you know, inevitably we look at the cost to us, the cost to the investor. But there could well be costs which can't easily be measured, or historically haven't been easily measured, which arise as a result of that investment. And you can think of, you know, deterioration in the environment, emissions of carbon dioxide, and so on, which is something which society may be more than willing to accept. But if the cost is a public cost, it's very difficult to identify, and it's very difficult to sort of take those actions to deal with it and ameliorate it. And I think that with sort of carbon dioxide trading, possibility of levies, that, and social cost-benefit analyses, we are moving in a situation where you can take a more complete picture from society's point of view of economic investments that parts of society, companies and so on want to make, and ensure that increasingly the full cost is reflected and the benefit measured accordingly. Even though that may be unsatisfactory, I believe it is improving. If we look at differently organized societies, like historically Russia, where there was a command economy and where there was no give and take politically, we do see that the environmental situation, the health situation and so on, was managed infinitely worse than was true in the West, where you have the checks and balances that I've referred to. A gentleman called David Henderson, who probably you will be more familiar with than me, because he was chief economist of OECD historically, has in fact just published a paper called Misguided Virtue. It is actually suggesting that the pursuit of corporate social responsibility, separate and in parallel with the economic objectives of companies, is destructive rather than accretive. And that if pursued, society will end up overall worse off rather than better. So for those reasons, and I'm not saying that I'm reflecting the views of the company I work for, because I'm certainly not entirely, but for those reasons, I personally think that a minimalist approach, general laws within which companies and the rest of us fit, is the way to manage concerns of the type that we're discussing this evening, rather than specific actions, which I think tend to be more arbitrary and discriminatory. Right, well, thank you very much.
Well, last but not least, Norina Hutz. She's just written a book called The Silent Takeover. Now she's going to take over, and not silently either.
Meghna, no, definitely not silently. Thank you both, Adele and Paul, for I think, Adele, you laid out a position that I'm really going to build upon, and Paul, you raised some points which I'm probably going to fight against. In the discussion period, I'm very happy to discuss in further whether the world is getting better. I'd say 30,000 children dying every single day under the age of 5 from preventable diseases, which are being prevented in the West, doesn't actually show great success. I think the fact that there are 9 million American households who have uncertain access to food isn't a mark of success. And the fact that of the world's poorest economies, the poorest economies actually have been getting poorer over the past 10 years. So I'd contest that, but we can go back to that. And I'd also contest, whilst I still have the opportunity up here, your Russia point. If in any way you were inferring that things are getting better in Russia, because if you look at life expectancy or if you look at environmental degradation there, we're seeing kind of real plummeting in life expectancy over the past 10 years and problems with environmental degradation. But back to the issue at stake and back to the subject of corporate social responsibility. I don't agree with everything that's been said, but I do actually not disagree with everything that's been said. Also with things that you've said, Paul, you'll be relieved to know. After I started with that awful kind of incredibly rude attack. You know, like Adele, I do believe that civil society and consumers do have a clear role to play in holding corporations to account, and that they've been playing this role. I mean, thank you for the historical perspective, because it's easy to forget how long this has been going on for. But I'd argue that really over the past 7 years, we've seen, and I'd use Shell, Brent Spar, and Greenpeace as the kind of watershed. I'd say since that point, we've really seen an acceleration of civil society action specifically targeted towards corporations. And so I agree that that has a real role. And like you, Adele, too, I also believe that some companies, though I might stress more significantly than you the word some, are beginning to take corporate responsibility and corporate citizenship more seriously. BP did buy Amoco, but it has joined forces with Global Witness on the issue of publishing what it pays, making transparent payments to countries where hitherto transparency had not been forthcoming. A recent case in the United States where some of the biggest names in corporate America, PepsiCo, Microsoft, General Motors, only last month took a very strong stance over the issue of affirmative action in American universities, arguing that universities should be allowed to consider race as a factor in admissions, a position that put them very much in collision course with President Bush. I also do hear what you're saying, Paul, and I do agree that for most companies, issues of human rights, environmental standards, labor standards, diversity, are not actually on the agenda. If we look at the widest survey of corporate social responsibility carried out in Britain late last year of 500 companies, we saw that only 4 out of 10 companies actually discuss on their boards social and environmental issues routinely or occasionally. And only 1/3 of these organizations had a board member with a specific environmental remit, and only 1/5 with a specific social remit. Or take a recent study of Canadian companies, which showed that these companies, the majority of large Canadian companies operating abroad, do not contain references to even the most basic human rights standards. So I would say that I don't think it's really that there's such as big a trend towards corporate social responsibility as you may be fearing. But I feel that most companies feel, like you do, that these are not core business issues. And that even if they did want to address these issues, issues of human rights, environmental standards, labor standards, even if they did want to invest in communities and social programs in areas in which they operate, how on earth could they justify this to their shareholders? A position that is understandable and that has precedence. In 1972, Kodak tried in Alabama to give money to a black civil rights organization, and its shareholders rose up in arms and said, what are you doing with our money? Okay, so we've got, 2 distinct positions, and I'm going to exaggerate your position, Adele, just for the purposes of this, the kind of Adele and Paul position, so to speak. And why should we try and unpack these differences some more? Well, I think understanding this difference is absolutely essential if we want to understand the limitations of civil and market regulation, which is essentially the form of regulation that Adele was laying out, and also if we want to understand how to move this debate forward. Because the position that you laid out, Adele, is essentially predicated, although you did give caveats which I completely agree with and will come to later, but essentially predicated on the basis that voluntary self-regulation can work reasonably well because of market and civil pressure. And again, I am exaggerating your position. Whereas your position, Paul, is, as I understand it, that civil and market-based forms of pressure are not impacting upon the business case in a way that necessitates or indeed gives companies the legitimacy to take on social and environmental issues. And I think there's a problem with both of these positions. First, and Adele, you did raise a lot of these problems that I will echo. First, voluntary self-regulation doesn't often or often doesn't work. Civil and consumer-based enforcement mechanisms are often not sufficient. Why not? Well, I'll give just a few reasons. First, as you raised, it's only visible brands that tend to get spotlighted by consumer and NGO and grassroots activists' forces. Invisible brands secondary goods producers, smaller multinational companies, companies which are not brand dependent, are, as you so rightly raised and highlighted, Adele, slipping under the radar screen, which means that rather than a level playing field being created with all corporations subject to the same set of rules, a whole host of corporations are able quite easily to escape censure. Second, success by both NGOs and grassroots activists is predicated upon whether or not there is a market response to their campaigns on the part of consumers. But by handing over governance to the market, we risk those social concerns deemed as being most popular by customers being those embraced by corporations in the West, with minority interests or unattractive causes often getting pushed aside. Rights to freely associate, for example, are often, for example, not included in decisions by the buying public on whether or not to buy something, whereas environmental matters more traditionally are. And third, we must remember that all this market-led pressure on corporations to deliver on social and environmental matters accelerated during a period of unprecedented economic boom. Customers, many of whom themselves were reaping the rewards of the good times, proved to be socially minded, and even in some cases were willing to pay more to have companies dispense global justice on their behalf. But now that we are in a downturn, and especially, as you raise, with the war looming, cost-cutting is becoming more essential, and the emphasis on price is likely to again become paramount, which raises the question, do we not run the risk that customers' priorities will change and corporations' priorities follow suit? Will consumer politics become ever more just the preserve of the middle classes and the rich, and in other cases, just wither away? And fourth, even if political shoppers want to factor in social and environmental issues into their purchasing decisions, they are stymied by so doing by a real lack of information as to what companies are actually doing. Although most FTSE 100 companies do now produce these glossy environmental and social reports, these are well nigh impossible to monitor, as you raise again, Adele, or assess. While, for example, in 2000, 45% of the top 240 global companies did report on non-financial matters, only 29% of these were independently verified. Market mechanisms rely upon sufficiently informed consumers to be effective. Uninformed stakeholders lack the relevant information to hold corporations to account. So despite the spotlight effect, despite the fact that companies will increasingly do their business surrounded by the clamour of critical public opinion, and in the past 12 months, for example, 29% of Britain's polled said that they have actually actively boycotted a product for an environmental or social reason, despite a number of successes on the parts of NGOs and grassroots activists and political shoppers, I believe that relying on the market or civil society to regulate multinational corporations and to determine between trustworthy and untrustworthy companies will never suffice. Where your argument falls down, Paul, is that although it's true that civil and consumer pressures may, in several cases and in several industries, not be strong enough or organized enough to create a business case for good corporate citizenship, investors are increasingly factoring environmental and social practices into their investment decisions. So the Association of British Insurers, for example, which controls $2 trillion worth of investment funds, issued in October 2001 guidelines which call for companies to disclose in their annual reports that they have identified the significant risks to their business arising out of the social, environmental, and ethical matters. Or CalPERS, America's largest public pension fund, now has a human rights screen for its overseas equity investments. And I've been called in by many by now, leading international institutional investors who want advice on the risks associated with investing in socially or environmentally vulnerable firms. And why are investors so concerned about this? Well, partly because they witness the rising interest of consumers and civil society in social and environmental issues, the issues that you raised, Adele, but largely because they perceive, as do the more far-sighted companies too, that the regulatory climate in which corporations are behaving is also significantly evolving, and that the risks associated with bad environmental practice or social practices can be huge today and in the future. Indeed, what we've been seeing over the past few years is, as you alluded to, Adele, a marked increase in both international laws, frameworks, norms, conventions pertaining to corporate behaviour, things like the Basel Convention on the Movement of Hazardous Waste, the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, the establishment of a new criminal court where we have tobacco companies seeking legal advice currently on whether their directors may be held personally liable at the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity, for producing products that are killing millions of people. And we're also seeing an increase in litigious actions by non-governmental organizations, pressure groups, and civil plaintiffs from countries of the South, as well as the North, as a way to hold companies to account. Cases like those taking place in the United States currently under the Alien Tort Claims Act, the Unocal Burma case, but also Coca-Cola, for example, currently being sued for allegedly being complicit in human rights abuses in its Colombian bottling plants. Or cases like the Cape Asbestos case, in which South African workers were able to take a case here in the United Kingdom to hold a British mining company to account for the actions that it undertook in South Africa, a case that the plaintiffs actually won. What we're seeing is an emerging patchwork of rules, norms, and international standards which investors and companies can no longer ignore. Of course, these are still early days, and I don't want to give the impression that the regulatory environment has as yet significantly transformed, but what is clear is that this is an area that is changing, especially given that an increasing number of public figures are adding their voices to a need to hold companies ever more externally to account. The World Health Organization's new initiative directed against fast food companies. Renato Ruggiero, the former head of the World Trade Organization, calling for a World Environment Organization. Guy Verhofstadt, the current Prime Minister of Belgium, the former President of the EU, who, while he was president of the EU, called for global binding agreements on corporations, on ethics, and the environment. Supachai, the new head of the World Trade Organization, talking about a need, again, for global binding regulations on corporations. The 11th hour success at Johannesburg, which, thanks to NGO pressure, resulted in the inclusion in the implementation plan of a commitment to make companies act responsibly through national and international legislative means. And ironically, this move towards more regulation, traditionally the bête noire of big business, may not be such a bad thing for them, after all. Because in the absence of legislative enforcement mechanisms, non-governmental organizations, grassroots activists, and political shoppers themselves take on not only the role of global policemen, but often judge and jury, which is, of course, potentially problematic. And while I do not want for a second to disparage the work of the many highly professional activists and campaigners out there, there is a question of who will guard the guardians, of who will hold them accountable, of who will ensure that they do not abuse their power, and a question of how corporations will ever know that what they are doing is enough. Questions that a more active focus on rules, on formal, codified arrangements that would hold both corporations and activists to a clearly defined set of standards would actually resolve. Shell, for example, has spent millions on environmental reporting programs, but still remains under siege from environmentalists who do not recognize these programs as legitimate. Nike, likewise, has gone to great lengths to enforce its own code of conduct, a code that many activists still see as grossly inadequate. The problem is that without any objective standard for what constitutes acceptable practice, firms will always be at the mercy of their critics, and that without an objective standard, without any rules, firms are left bearing the burden of response. And the smartest firms are beginning to recognize this. They are beginning to realize that in a time of rising public pressure like this, fighting the imposition of rules is a losing strategy. And my interpretation of the Honda case is different to yours, Paul, because if we look at the regulatory context within which Honda entered the United States in the 60s and 70s, what was happening then was that you had an environmental movement which had risen up in America, which was lobbying very, very strongly for new legislation, for the Clean Air Act, for laws which would actually curb the ability of big cars to operate and be commercially as viable. Honda very cleverly recognized where the puck was going, saw that regulation was kind of likely to come, and front-run the regulation with its strategy of developing cleaner, more efficient cars. And today, we do see companies like Nike and BP amongst a number of companies that have actually begun to be calling for clearer regulations themselves, knowing that it's likely to come. Indeed, in most cases, rules create a far better environment over the long run than uncertainty. Companies are better off dealing with clear and well-defined standards than responding to a host of diffuse and often contradictory demands. High-profile companies in particular are also better served by standards that apply across the board and not only to the largest or more visible firms. Strange as it may seem, forward-looking companies can actually use public pressure to their benefit by anticipating the rules and not fighting them. Firms can not only protect themselves from the slings and arrows of activists, they can actually gain the thing they want most: competitive advantage. Thank you.
Well, I think you will agree that that was a very interesting three-part presentation. I could almost put a Hegelian structure on it, because Adele told us about how civil society actions are having effect on corporations. She pointed out some of the problems, but basically civil society points out externalities and adverse consequences of business activity, and they kind of have to be responded to. But then, as sort of she pointed out, then Paul said, like, you know, basically these are arbitrary, unpredictable, unelected, and very often fashion-driven interventions in corporate matters. Very often, only go after the more visible, more glamorous names. And so Paul was saying, no, he prefers a minimalist approach in which corporations obey rules. They do nothing else. All else is kind of luxury. Yes, you should do it perhaps if you're going to have to pay a cost, but you shouldn't really do it. And I think Norina actually said, look, no, what we really want to do is to treat, as it were, civil society as not reliable, but as an advance guards or advance beacons of what might be a problem. And then if people think there are serious enough problems, then we ought to internalize them into rules, so that these rules are then level playing field for all corporations. So you're not driven by headline corporations being subjected to pressure, sometimes, as in the case of Nike, as Adele pointed out, ignorant pressure, because people are not caught up with the fact that, you know, the case of 5 years ago may have been superseded. So we arrive at a thing saying what we really want are rules, and rules created by people who were, as it were, given the responsibility of creating rules, who have some democratic legitimacy of creating rules. And corporations will prefer rules because they'd rather have clear, visible, binding standards to respond to, rather than having, you know, kind of playing this, what everyone's called, three-dimensional chess with civil society organizations, where you never know which, you know, your operations in third world countries may be objected to by first world standards, and you are kind of operating on several levels. So I think we have a very, very good kind of synthesis, but there's also lots of disagreement, lots of differences, and I'm sure you all want to ask hundreds of questions to the speakers. And I always say this, let's have questions. In the House of Lords, we have a rule, which I always tell people, you always know about House of Lords rules, that when you ask a question to a minister, it has to start by saying, does the minister agree with me that? Yeah. No statements before. Certainly not a summary of what the speaker has said, which very often is given back to the speaker. They all know what they said, and we all know what they said. And what we know is, what we want to know is not what you think, but what are your questions. So let's, and equitably, that will make more time for questions. So it's an equity towards your fellow listeners. Yes, there and then there. Then the second one is behind it. Yeah.
Hi, thank you very much. It's been very interesting.
Can you speak, Evan?
Sorry, discussions. Can everyone hear me now? Great.
I can.
If I can just pick up on really what Norina, you were saying about the whole issue of regulation, which I think is really important to put a sort of business case across for regulation. What my question is who will devise and be in charge, if you like, of devising these regulations and standards? Will there be global organisations that already exist? Will we want to invent new ones? If so, will the regulations be dominated by northern companies, as I think we've seen in, say, the Global Compact? And once again, if we do have these standards, are we going to run the risk of catch-up, that the big, articulate and fluent companies already who are in this debate are the ones who are setting the standards that southern organizations and companies are going to have to try and pick up on?
Okay. The person behind who also had a question. Yeah. I'll take a cluster of questions and we'll answer them all. Okay. That Jenny there, and then a person there in the second row. Yeah.
With the recent trend towards neoliberal economics, I'm wondering if there really is a trend towards increased regulation or away from regulation, especially of corporations, and in the instance of dispute settlement mechanisms where firms can take cases against governments that impede their business practices. I'm wondering if this is a realistic trend that we'll see towards increased regulation of corporate behavior.
Okay. The gentleman there. Who is next?
I wonder if I could just pick up on a point.
Can you stand up?
I wonder if I could just pick up on a point that Adele Simmons made about the, as I understand it, the difference between, well, sometimes the difference between what appears important to Western campaigners and what is actually important on the ground. Certainly a lot of my research, I've finished a book on this subject about multinational companies in developing countries. Certainly my research suggests that there is often this difference between what appears important in the West and what's important on the ground. I guess my particular question is because you're suggesting that we need to get the Western NGOs, Western campaigners to focus on what is most important to local people. But given that the Western NGOs, many of them are dependent upon Western support and Western funds, and often those people in the West aren't actually that concerned about the real local issues, how do you get over that particular problem?
Yeah. Great. There are more questions. Anyway, so why don't you go first, and then Adele and then Paul.
Thank you for, I think you raised some very important questions about how, in practice, can we move to a kind of more stringent regulatory regime, and also what's the danger that these regulations will actually be in the interest only of northern multinational companies, and that companies in the south, you know, will just not be able to reach these kind of labor standards or environmental standards that are imposed on them. I think both of those are very important questions to try and address. You know, do I think that we need new organizations? I mean, I'm loath to suggest the setting up of a completely brand new global organization, and you know, there's probably space within the UN framework for this kind of body. Although, when you think that the operating budget of the United Nations is only $1.25 billion a year, and Americans spend $27 billion a year on confectionery, you know, you do start thinking, what actually can the UN do? So I think, you know, there probably is space somewhere for essentially an organization which does protect and have its mandate social and environmental standards and rights. You have existing organizations, of course, like the ILO, which already are in place and are international, or UNDP. They just don't have the force and the kind of the ability to actually enforce the stuff that they're doing. So, you know, there's a question of creating the political will domestically to cede power to these international institutions. And I don't think that will happen legitimately if the South feels that overnight they're going to be told, you know, you've got to be having no sweatshops, no child labour, your wages have got to be a certain minimum wage that we decide, and your environmental standards have got to be on par with ours. But I think that doesn't mean that we shouldn't aspire to a whole host of standards, a whole host of rights that everyone should be accorded. So the question is, can we have some kind of recognition that countries are at different starting points, and have some kind of aspirational standards that we move towards? And then how do we incentivize, provide aid, assistance to companies so that they can, to countries so that they can areas? And you know, the ILO actually has quite an interesting project in Cambodia, where it's been working with the US Trade Department on providing some kind of incentives if the Cambodian government actually meets ILO standards. So I think there are ways of kind of incentivizing, but we definitely have to recognize that countries are starting at different points, and we have to put money and resources and commitment into helping countries reach other points. The question that you raised about you know, increased regulation and the problem of the dispute settlement mechanisms, you were referring to cases presumably like the NAFTA Metalclad case, where you had an American company the Mexican government losing a case when an American company said that it was tantamount to the expropriation of its investment when the Mexican authorities said that they wouldn't allow a waste, I think it was a nuclear waste facility, to be built in their premises, or cases like the case in California, which I'm not sure if it's been resolved yet, about MTBE, this fuel additive, gasoline additive, which a Canadian company was saying, if that's banned, that will be tantamount to an expropriation of our profits. So there is a real danger in international law, which you legitimately raise, whose interests are being protected. The same question can be asked of the World Trade Organization, not looking at companies, but at whose countries, which countries' interests are being promoted and pushed in that framework. More transparency, more, you know, is clearly needed, and more thought in lawmaking. I mean, now there has been concern after the Metalclad ruling that that was actually a bad ruling, and that is something that has been made explicit now amongst legal circles. But I think these are real dangers and possible conflicts.
Let me just say one little interjection before. Since we are on Dutch television, I can say something about Belgium. Norina pointed out how the Belgian Prime Minister made a radical call for something or other. What they will never make a radical call for is abolition of the common agricultural policy, which is real crime against humanity. And I'd rather Leonard Jospin have talked about that than about Tobin tax. Anyway.
Just a quick comment on where these laws come from. I'm not going to answer that question, but one step that I'm involved in is trying to get some alignment amongst all these different civil society groups that have different codes of conduct. Because if you can get some agreement between companies and civil society about what the rules of the game are, it's going to be much easier for any group to move forward. On your question about how do you get what's important at the local level back to the civil society groups, I don't think it's that difficult. I think people didn't know. We now have a body of research that has come out of social science groups working in Thailand and Bangladesh, et cetera, that are identifying these priorities. The last, and I think if you can get that information back to campuses and back to the civil society groups, the last thing any one of these virtually very self-righteous groups want to be accused of being is Western and imposing their views on workers in Thailand. So I think there will be sympathy if you can get good information back and forth, and I think the companies will respond. The other line is that a bunch of these things that we're seeing in this research are a lot cheaper than what is being asked for. So I think it's possible. Funders, certainly the US foundations are very sensitive to this. I did a lot of site visits when I was president of MacArthur. What's important? We funded very local groups to get us this information. So I don't think it needs to be done, but I think it can be done.
I think with regard to legislation and rules, we have them at a national level, but we also have them at regional levels. We've got a lot of legislation coming out of Brussels. The EU is going to embrace some 25 countries and grow beyond that over the next 3 or 4 years. In North America, you've got NAFTA, and they're looking to extend that to South America. And you've certainly got the framework of the UN in the way that Norina has highlighted. I think that, picking up Magnet's point, the point I was going to raise with regard to jumping over the middle question to your question about local values and local needs. And I have a little bit to do with South Africa. When Mandela was elected as president, he was greeted most warmly in Europe and America. But particularly in Europe, the EU said that they would organize a treaty which would encourage the sort of development of agricultural produce and so on, importing from South Africa to Europe. I happen to know the people who were negotiating on the South African side. I think that the negotiations took something like 5 years or more. The generosity of spirit which was communicated by the heads of states was certainly not reflected by the European civil servants who were negotiating. They really nickel and dimed the South Africans, and essentially, coming back to Magnus' point, it was much more important for them, given their domestic political constituency, to protect, for example, CAP, than to create inducements and motivations for South African projects to come into Europe. I think locally also, with regard to uniform standards, that can be very destructive. In South Africa, you have a minimum wage. That has a negative effect in that many small companies, sole proprietors and so on, who want to start businesses, simply can't afford to pay that. And in the sort of market, unemployment in South Africa is, 30% or something like that, in that kind of environment, you know, many, many people would be willing to work for half that minimum wage and be better off than they are by not working at all. I would like to see a framework there within which the market had a stronger right. I mean, I think actually South Africa are managing their economy in a very positive way. But modification of these rules and rigidities, I think, would actually help economic growth rather than hinder it. And, you know, one could dispute, but it's a political dispute, not a company dispute, the values and the priorities as one moves forward.
Okay. Are there any more questions? Let me. Yeah. So in the front here, and then the person in the back. Yeah.
Hi. Narina raised the issue of competitive advantage turning corporate social. Narina mentioned the issue of turning corporate responsibility into a competitive advantage. I wonder what would Paul think about that, and in terms of also the arbitrariness of it? I mean, there are companies out that are actually turning it into a kind of a market, almost a marketing ploy. BP and Shell come to mind. But how do people think about that?
The gentleman there.
Yeah, I'm wondering what Adele's thoughts are on when civil society isn't necessarily protecting the rights or what we might conceive.
Sorry, can you move away a little bit?
Yep. What are the implications when civil society isn't protecting what we might consider good? So, you know, farmers in Europe are very much in favor of CAP, and I think we could consider them civil society. And what does that mean for the structure of civil society driving policy?
The gentleman there.
I don't really understand how civil society can make a difference so long as underlying processes are making companies less accountable. And in particular, I'd just like to draw attention to one instrument, and that is the host government agreement. Companies are reaching agreements with governments that exempt them from any laws that might impose any costs or liabilities on them. Now, from Paul's perspective, that is a company minimizing its risk and uncertainty, passing that risk on to governments and to communities where it operates. But no amount of juniors spending years of their lives in sequoia trees, surely, and no number of civil society organizations can create the kind of risks that that companies are being able to offload using instruments such as host-government agreements.
Okay. Anybody else dying to answer a question? Okay, the lady there.
Comment about who guards the guardians. And a question, Adele, you mentioned sort of NGO codes of conduct, and I wondered if any of you would comment on initiatives you're aware of amongst international NGOs, sort of setting up voluntary codes between themselves on their own accountability and sort of peer reviews, or if anything's happening in that area.
Okay. Shall I start with you this time?
Yes, well, let me start with the competitive advantage question. I mean, if we look at oil, as has been noted in the discussion this evening, Shell have pursued this whole area of corporate social responsibility very aggressively. BP have done the same. And you could perhaps argue that Exxon have differentiated themselves competitively from the actions of their European, or the positioning of their European competitors. And Lee Raymond was, I think, interviewed in the Financial Times a couple of weeks ago and poured a lot of cold water over Kyoto, global warming, and argued that you know, the data was unreliable and it would be arbitrary and irresponsible to spend a lot of money, which facts and the future could show was wasted. I mean, provided the playing field is level and I'm in full agreement with sort of regulation and guidelines and rules of a sort of anonymous general type, the type that Norina was identifying, I mean, I think it's good that the oil companies position themselves differently with regard to that particular issue. And time will tell. And I think what you will see, and you know, I think what is good and encouraging about the market economy is that if Shell and BP turn out to be correct, I would be astonished if you didn't find Exxon's position changing. And if Exxon turns out to be correct, I would be equally astonished not to find BP and Shell sort of over a period of time, because these are long lead time, long payout time businesses, reinterpreting their position. In practice, the philosophy from which perhaps Molina is coming and from which I'm coming may be significantly different. But in practice, even though economic surpluses and profit are the prime objective sort of in my world, competitive positioning, sort of as you develop your strategy, is a key driver. Now, does it come from cost? Does it come from values you communicate? In some cases, it's quite objective. In other cases, it's very subjective. It might be, you know, quite fashionable. And if these things related to the environment are important and provide competitive advantage, and I'm talking about something which goes beyond regulation, because we're talking about companies which, let's take for granted, are good corporate citizens, like we are all good individual citizens, then they will pursue that you know, particular avenue. And you know, I'm quite happy to sort of, you know, let a thousand flowers bloom in regard to this. And in many ways, if I look at the, say, management of capital and so on, I'm more concerned with the accountability of governments than I am with companies. Companies are, the weakest government is stronger than the strongest company, you know, within its sort of jurisdiction.
Okay.
Couple things. First of all, there are big alliances of these standard-setting groups, and in fact, they all met about last month in Europe. The Global Reporting Initiative in the U.S., for example, includes companies, it includes NGOs, and when you can get the companies and the NGOs to agree, then you're kind of moving towards something that is some common standard. The truly flaky NGOs often end up without funding, end up without reporters taking them seriously, and one way or another eventually are marginalized. This doesn't always happen perfectly, but that's right now the best we have. And I have a feeling that people wouldn't like something that was regulated or controlled. But there's a very interesting new competition that's emerging. So you can imagine if you were the president of Thailand or Vietnam or whatever, you would be enormously worried about all these companies moving to China. And what's beginning to happen, and I just heard the Vietnamese, I don't have, this is not confirmed, so don't quote it anywhere, but I'm just hearing that the Vietnamese now have decided their comparative advantage with China is going to be strong social responsible standards, so that the label produced in Vietnam will carry with it, not yet, standards that will be higher than the label produced in China. So they're beginning to use this as their marketing, as their comparative advantage approach. It's whether that really is going to happen, I don't know, but it's an interesting idea.
That's a really wonderful thought. The question, the point that was raised about civil society and you know, what about when civil society actually isn't promoting good? And I think when we talk about this amorphous thing, civil society, we can romanticize it and forget that civil society is the anti-abortionists as well as the pro-abortionists. It's the, you know, it's civil society is the José Bové French nationalistic interest constituency, as well as people championing the rights of excluded and marginalized elsewhere. And I think that's right. And I think the problem with civil society, and why ultimately I'm a firm believer in the power of representative democracy, is because that's what, in theory at least, representative democracy is supposed to be able to do. It's supposed to be able to mitigate different interests and protect, ideally, minority interests as well.
as to the point raised about the companies reaching agreements with governments that basically are allowing them to then bypass and kind of not have to face any regulatory standards, and I think I'm not sure which oil company recently was it BP? Right. Yes, that is, you know, we have to ask ourselves, why does this come about? You know, why are countries in such weak bargaining positions that they have to allow companies to be able to demand all these kind of special rules and privileges just so that they come and invest? And why this is so is because of things like the fact that subsidies to developing countries are costing, subsidies on agriculture are costing developing countries $2 billion a day there, because of things like the fact that aid has fallen in real terms by 45% to developing countries over the past 10 years. They are to do with the fact that countries are paying huge debt repayments still in environments when they desperately need money in order to be able to provide social services and deal with health. So I think the way that we need to deal with this kind of asymmetric power position is to, you know, actually put resources and ensure and do all we can so that developing countries actually are in a stronger bargaining position. And yes, besides the global reporting initiative, there was also, to relate to the question about accountability of NGOs, there's an initiative currently going on under the auspices here of Charter 66, and it's the Global Accountability Report, which is also working at holding NGOs as well as global corporations to account.
Okay, I think we have had a very, very good run. Are you absolutely dying to ask a question? Because I really want to wind this up at 8 o'clock. And that is the time when we're supposed to empty this hall. But yes, ask your question here, because I think you want to ask a question. I don't want to exclude anybody.
Is it on? I'm sorry to take up
your time. Your college.
My question was, well, there are two questions. Do you think that there's more relationship now than ever before between governments and corporations? Is there a closer link? And my other question is, Paul, about I'm not quite sure about government accountability as opposed to corporate accountability. But when you read that oil companies have representatives in every department of government, in the education department, in social services, in health, then it's very difficult to believe that there isn't a huge influence from corporations. And how can the government be free in the development of public-private finance? The relationship seems to be getting closer and closer between government and corporations.
Okay, thanks. Mary. Oh, yeah. Mary, keep it short. Mary, and then lady over there.
Am I allowed to make a comment?
Very short question. You should have spoken long ago. Yes.
Okay. Do you agree?
Yes.
I'm very struck by the fact that, in a way, both Narina and Paul believe in the power of states. And I was very struck by Paul's remark that even the weakest state, it reminds me actually of Lukács' remark that even the worst socialism is better than the best capitalism. I'm very sceptical about your argument. We know the scale of corporations, and the problem that we face now is that we live in a world where states are rather weak and they're often rather oppressive. And that's where civil society comes in,
exactly,
for all its inequalities, unrepresentativeness. So having listened to this debate, not sure where I stand, I end up actually on Adele's side because of globalization. Because states have become weaker, markets have become weaker, and you've got this really 18th century balancing world,
okay,
on a global scale.
Yeah, that's enough. Yeah. Thank you. Lady there, yeah. That's an absolutely positive the last question. Yeah.
Also, in the light of the not to be quoted story about Vietnam, do you think there is any scope and to what extent for corporate social responsibility to provide a substitute to sanctions?
Okay.
Through sanctions.
Sanctions, oh, I see. Okay.
Against that.
Okay, who's going to go first?
I think there's a relationship between your question, Mary, and the earlier question about governments and corporations, and is there a closer relationship between them today. In 1876, US presidential candidate Rutherford Hayes said of America, this is a government of corporations, by corporations, for corporations. So, I mean, you know, this problem has been around for some time.
Either he was wrong, or you can't get much closer than that.
But I think what we do see today and what is kind of manifestly different, and we see it most clearly in the United States, where we have the issue of political funding of election campaigns, is that when George W. needs $191 million to have in his war chest, he's going to go to corporations. And in exchange for that, there is going to be a quid pro quo. And when you have Enron jets kind of flying around Bush supporters around Florida, around the kind of electoral debacle date, I mean, you have to start questioning. And when you have an environmental...
They never got anything right, did they?
Exactly.
That's why they shut down.
Another disaster.
Another corporate disaster.
And when you have, you know, $47 million being spent in campaign funding by energy companies, and the US kind of turning its back on Kyoto and various environmental kind of... not complying to various environmental standards, you know, you do legitimately say, is there a problem here? So Mary, I mean, I don't want you for a second to think that I believe that governments haven't been ceding power to big multinational corporations. I definitely believe that they have. But I do aspire to a world in which states do regain control, and I do think that that's where civil society really has the biggest role to play in kind of re-legitimizing the state and in making sure that the state actually protects a public interest rather than a corporate special one.
I don't want to add anything like amen to that. or want to say anything
important?
No,
I just want to wimp out
completely. Okay, very good. This is a free country. You can wimp out.
I just want to assure everyone that before I'm quoted or misquoted, my company is much closer to BP and Shell than it is to Exxon. In the way it positions itself.
We will find out about that.
To some extent, I clearly don't agree with that.
Yeah. You want to say something?
Just to conclude, if you can work on the ground with a lot of these corporations in terms of their connections with the government, the big problem, and Paul may comment on that, is that when you're working out a contract with Nigeria, now we're getting models so that that money doesn't go directly to the Nigerian government for the Swiss bank accounts, but it's being set up in trust funds for educational purposes and other things like that. This is something that has emerged since Nigeria. BP is doing it in Angola. There are real opportunities now for setting up different ways of using profits that these local governments make. Resources don't move. Resource companies have to invest in certain places. They don't have a choice. The apparel industry can go wherever it wants, and there are huge industry differences because of that.
Okay, I'm just going to say one sort of short concluding thing, that in a sense what really is interesting is, A, it's a very dynamic situation, things change all the time. And in a sense, some sense civil society warns that these troubles are coming. And a weak state may sign an agreement with the corporation, but the corporation's consumer in the first world are going to take it apart by boycotting. In that case, the weak state is strengthened by an agency it doesn't control. And, you know, sort of, if you look at Brent Spar, although I think Greenpeace are horrendously wrong about the ecology of it, Brent Spar, you know, they had government support, and John Major was very upset that they had been supporting in Parliament. And when the consumer boycott started, the corporation collapsed. Now, later on, this leads to legislation. And of course, once the legislation, people find new ways to avoiding legislation. And this kind of goes on. But, you know, when the state is weak, we call the state is weak. The state is weak about certain things, like state ownership of means of production. But it has shifted agenda to other things which people care about. And some of them are raised by corporate social responsibility. I mean, in a sense, so there is kind of hope and despair. But, you know, in a sense, I never promised you a perfect world. So thank you all for coming.
Thank you.